Well, hello and welcome to the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District's inaugural conservation podcast episode. My name is Franny Jurdy with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm the urban conservationist, and I'm super happy to have John with me here today with the U of M Turfgrass Science Department to talk all about lawn care basics and lawn care best management practices. So John, do you want to give a quick introduction and maybe a little background on yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me, Franny. So my name is John Trappi. I'm the Turfgrass Extension Educator for the state of Minnesota. What that means is I am a part of the University of Minnesota Extension, and my job is to basically provide any kind of outreach resources to really anyone that handles turf within the state of Minnesota. So it could be homeowners, they could be turf professionals within the industry, like golf course superintendents, athletic field managers, or even cemetery maintainers, for example. So it's really just kind of a wide breadth of an industry, but you know, my job is to basically communicate up-to-date research and what we know about a given subject to homeowners and professionals alike, just to help them basically maintain their turf a little bit better and potentially with some fewer resources, if at all possible.
Excellent. So turf or lawn care isn't exactly, you know, in the wheelhouse of most conservation districts, but more and more we're finding it's actually a really great opportunity to do conservation on the land, because it just takes up so much land mass. In the country alone, turfgrass takes up about, what, 3 times more land than irrigated corn. So we thought it would be really great to kind of talk about ways landowners can maybe reduce their environmental impacts, because everybody that, or at least most people that live in a house, have lawn of some kind. And so not everybody has acres upon acres that they could do a prairie restoration or lakefront property that they can do shoreline restorations. So this is a way that we can reach more people to do conservation practices. So I'm super happy to have you here to be the expert on turfgrass, since I'm definitely not. So how about we kind of start with the basics of turfgrass? What exactly is turfgrass? What are the grass species that are typically found, maybe like the most common, that are in most lawns? Because you buy a house and there's a lawn there, and I'm sure most people don't really know what species are in that grass. So what would a homeowner typically find in their turfgrass?
So we refer to turfgrasses as a grass that has some kind of utility or function, and that's where the turf comes into it. So turf grasses in many cases are, they're not just something that is grown in a lawn. They're grown in all different types of places. Where people have most interaction with them is in their lawns. But, you know, they could be found on places like golf courses, cemeteries, airports, the roadside or right-of-way areas. So, turf grass is a really broad term, but in the context of lawns, we're mostly talking about just a couple of different species. And in Minnesota, it narrows it down even slightly further. So we have Kentucky bluegrass, which is the most commonly used turfgrass species in the state of Minnesota. Then we have perennial ryegrass, turf-type tall fescue, and then there are several different fine fescue species. But for conversational purposes, we can just kind of group those as one species and refer to them as just the fine fescues. But that's the majority of the grasses that are grown in really the entire Midwest, but especially the upper Midwest up in Minnesota.
And so I've definitely heard of Kentucky bluegrass. I feel like that's probably one of the grass species that is the most common thing that people hear about. How did Kentucky bluegrass get to be like the main grass used in lawns? I'm sure there's Kentucky bluegrass lawns in Maine. I'm sure there's Kentucky bluegrass lawns in California. How did this one grass species kind of become the main type of lawn grass that we typically see?
Well, it'll probably be a long form answer if you're looking for one. I could probably present for a couple of hours on it. But the really quick answer is that Kentucky bluegrass spreads by rhizomes. And so what that means is that it can recover from stresses like traffic or let's say weeds or maybe winter damage. So Kentucky bluegrass can compete pretty well within the landscape and can fill in voids and basically make itself and provide a little bit more of a consistent surface. And so it's really commonly used in lawns and landscapes. And it's, you know, and that's part of the reason why it's dominated so well. And that's why it's so prevalent in sure. areas. But recently, there's been more interest in grasses that require a little bit less maintenance than Kentucky bluegrass. So mm-hmm. things like turf type tall fescue or the fine fescues, those are grasses that are a little bit more drought tolerant or drought avoidant in some cases, where they just basically have mechanisms or the ability to grow and thrive with less water. Mm-hmm. And of course there's always exceptions to the rule, because sometimes there's new and improved cultivars of Kentucky bluegrass that are quite drought tolerant. So it really just depends, but really, you know, the advancements that we've made in plant breeding, especially in turf grass breeding, has been the development of turf grasses that require substantially less maintenance than, say, cultivars that were planted, within the last, or, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. So, mm-hmm. There's always exceptions and there's always, caveats that you need to mention, but in general, the Kentucky bluegrass is the most common, but there are some kind of lower input turf grasses that are a little bit better adapted for what we're trying to accomplish with our lawns.
Okay. So would you recommend to people that have maybe, older properties that lawn was established like in the, 70s or 80s, where it is mostly the Kentucky bluegrass and less tolerant type species, would you recommend they like overseed with these newer varieties that the U of M is coming out with that are a little more drought tolerant and hardy to Minnesota?
I don't know if I would necessarily make a conscientious effort to just go and kill off your existing lawn for the sake of planting a lower input grass. And part of the reason why I say that is because we just don't have the data to say that that doing that would be worth it from a financial standpoint or from mm-hmm. like a water savings standpoint. We know like direct comparisons that they're much more drought tolerant, but you know, you're going to need some more water to water in those plants as the seedlings, for example. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit nervous about saying that we should just go out to every lawn that's more than 10 years old and replant a new and improved cultivar. Mm-hmm. What I think is kind of a good happy medium or a suggestion there is if you have areas that have been stressed out in the past, like for example, the last two summers, we've lost a lot of grass from the drought and heat combined. Mm-hmm. And then this past winter, we had a really stressful winter where there was a lot of grass that was lost because of winter injury. And so I think in those cases where you have certain areas, I think those are great opportunities to select new and improved varieties. And in most cases, most people aren't going to recognize that they're newer and improved. You know, they look very much the same. Right. It's just they might be a little bit better adapted for that area that experienced that stress than, say, grasses that were bred maybe, 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if a person were to install a new lawn, though, you'd recommend those nicer new and improved mixes.
Exactly. I think it's really kind of fascinating. You know, people, their first thought process is like, oh, well, I should go out and buy a high quality lawnmower, for example. Mm-hmm. But, really the biggest impact that you're going to have on your lawn is what it's starting out as. Mm-hmm. And that's the grass seed. And if you think about it from an environmental perspective, grass seed has very little, greenhouse gas emissions associated with the production of the production of the grass seed. It's not like a fertilizer or irrigation or anything like that. It's or a pesticide. It's strictly organic, and it's anybody can plant grass seed. So mm-hmm. it's very easy to do, and the grasses themselves can have a tremendous impact on how your lawn is maintained, but still providing those same functional benefits that you found before. So I think of it as a great option for, you know, for really you get what you pay for, and it's a great option for getting, starting your lawn off on the right foot if you have that opportunity. And, you know, if it's worth mentioning, if somebody really cares, you know, many of the turf grasses that, well, not many, but some of the turf grasses that are, that you were to buy off the shelves, for example, are actually grown in Minnesota. So, so it's, in some cases you're supporting a local farmer. So in some exceptional cases, I think you are, but if you want to think into, you know, if that's important to you, I think that's, you know, something also worth considering.
And so when would be the best time to seed a new lawn, or maybe if you needed to do a little, patching up of lawn from winter injury or drought injury or anything like that, when would be the best time of the year to do that?
So there's really two times of the year that are great. And I would say the best option would be in the early fall and or late autumn. And that would be sometime for Sherburne County or anywhere within that area. It's probably looking somewhere around the third or fourth week of August, all the way until about the third, fourth week of September, maybe even the first week of October to for establishing those areas or reestablishing those areas by seed. So that's kind of that's the best time of the year. But also right now is still a pretty good time. One of the issues with trying to establish a lawn right now is all of the best management practices that you're going to be doing for trying to encourage grass seedlings to come in. You're also encouraging things like summer annual grassy weeds like crabgrass. So right now, you know, you may be able to do that, but you're going to struggle with some weeds. In the fall, the weed pressure is just significantly lower. So so that's why we recommend to do it then. And I think that's generally it's the better option.
Okay. This might be a silly question, but so when you're seeding in the like autumn timeframe, are you hoping for germination, or are you almost doing like a can you dormant seed grass seed? Like, because I'm just thinking, you know, native prairie, you can do dormant seedings where you're not planning on germination happening. Does grass seed work the same way, or is you really need to have that germination before winter comes?
That's a great question, Franny. So, and the answer is yes. So yes and yes to both of those questions. So you are hoping for germination in the autumn. So if you're doing that kind of early fall for trying to get the grass to germinate and emerge and hopefully even be mowed once or twice before the fall. Now, with that said, what you were referring to is something we call dormant seeding in the turf industry. And that's something that can absolutely happen for a lawn. And it's what we use to establish a lot of our turf research plots. And it's basically you prepare the seed bed in the fall. And as you know, we use germination blankets, so we don't have to worry about bare soil being exposed over the winter. But we basically seed knowing that the grass is not going to germinate until the following spring. Now, there is a risk with that, is that if you do get a warm up and you do see some warmer soil temperatures and you seed too early going into the winter, you could get some germination and emergence right before the winter. And then you have those seedlings that are kind of exposed to the elements. So there's a little bit of a risk, but generally it can be a very successful way of trying to establish or to convert an area to a or to improve an area over time is by dormant seeding. And really the beauty of the dormant seeding is that it can be done anytime after soils have frozen. So once the soils have frozen, the grass seed can basically sit there the whole winter. And so you can dormant seed in November, or you can dormant seed even in February or March whenever the snow melts. So it's a really versatile tool that can be used for trying to establish an area by seed.
What's the germination blanket? Is that like a straw erosion control blanket, or is that something different?
That's exactly right. So a germination blanket, you know, there's all kinds of different terms for them, but most of the time they're used, you know, people are probably most familiar with seeing them used on roadsides when they're trying to establish a right-of-way that has a slope. And that's because they can effectively hold the seed in place, the seed and soil in place. And so it's basically a way of holding the seed in place, you know, between, you know, rainfall or irrigation events, but it can also retain moisture and provide more suitable moisture and growing conditions for the grass seedlings as they're emerging.
Mm-hmm. Would you recommend like homeowners use germination blankets if they're trying to establish a new lawn, or is it not necessary on like larger scale lawn settings?
I think if somebody had the financial resources and wanted to use them, they would have much better germination if they did. The problem is that they can be quite costly.
Sure.
And so if you have an area that has any kind of slope, let's say, you know, you have any kind of difficulty, or even you have to even think about the slope as you're walking on it. If that's the case, then I would certainly consider using a germination blanket, maybe even considering sodding that area. But if you have a slope, germination blankets, great. If you don't have any slope, your lawn's relatively flat. As long as you stay on top of the watering once the plants have germinated, it's really, it can be a great tool, but it's not absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would you be able to kind of talk about grass life cycles of these type of grasses? And I'm assuming most of them are cool season, correct?
Yep,
maybe you want to explain what cool season means.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of these grasses that we're growing in our lawns, they've been where they originally came from. There are some that are truly native to North America, but the vast majority are native to Europe. Mm-hmm. And where we've been selecting them and collecting them for breeding purposes has mostly been, you know, kind of at elevations or at various elevations, or maybe certain climate conditions. Like if we wanted more drought tolerant grass, we've selected some from the Mediterranean, for example. So most of them are from Europe, but the cool season grass refers to the fact that and all of them are perennials. So we're not planting any annuals in our lawn. So they are plants that basically have their best growth and development at temperatures that are somewhere between 60 degrees, let's say 60 and 85 degrees Fahrenheit. And we call them cool season grasses because even though it's not necessarily cool, those are found and they're most well adapted for cooler climates. Mm-hmm. There are warm season grasses, and actually one of the most prominent native grasses to the United States is called buffalo grass. It's actually a warm season grass. And ironically, it is very well adapted to Minnesota. But that's a grass that prefers warmer temperatures. And it lays dormant for about 8 months of the year and then does all of its growing in those warmer conditions. And it's just a little bit better adapted. It's more adapted to the prairies that received much less natural rainfall. And so it didn't necessarily need warmer temperatures, just drier conditions, which we experience typically in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so a lot of Sherburne County, you know, it's very sandy. And so the original plant community that were there, mostly prairie oak savanna type habitat. And so a lot of our prairie plants are, like you mentioned, the buffalo grass, like little blue stem, big blue stem. Those are all warm season. And so like this time of year, you know, lawn grasses are already starting to get very green, but native prairie still looks kind of sad and brown. And I think that's really why people kind of gravitate towards lawn grasses, especially being in Minnesota. We're so ready to come out of that winter and see some kind of green vegetation. So having those cool season grasses is a nice sight after all the snow is melting to have something green up so early on.
Absolutely. Oh, I was just going to say, you know, if you think about, you know, much of the sports that we play and like, you know, even those types of things have influences on the grasses that we're growing in our lawn. So if you think about like football and baseball or, softball or, you know, most of those seasonal school sports, they're played, you know, really in the ideal cool season growing timeframes. And so that kind of lends to why we have so many cool season grasses that we're using in our lawns, is because quite frankly, that's when we're using them the most. So, people think about sports and things like that, and they think of them as summer activities, but, you know, a lot of times our football or lacrosse or anything like that, you know, those are taking place for the majority of the year in very cool temperatures. And so having plants that can grow at those lower temperatures is an advantage for those types of situations.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I didn't really think about. So let's kind of switch gears to talk a little bit about management of these grasses. I've already seen people, you know, in neighborhoods fertilizing with the granular fertilizers. Is now a good time that people should be fertilizing their lawns, or is there a better time of year for that?
So right now can be a good time. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's the preferred time. Mm-hmm. You know, it really just depends on how someone is using their lawn. And it really depends on how much they're putting down, of course. But generally speaking, what we're trying to do is, the plant itself is already waking up right now in the springtime. It's basically waking up because soil temperatures are increasing. Our soil organisms that are responsible for mineralizing nutrients and making them plant available, they're all warming, you know, they're all getting going. And so there's a lot of nutrients that are becoming available for the plants themselves. So mm-hmm. that's part of the reason why you see such a big flush of growth in the month of May in Minnesota, is because of this, this just natural soil cycles. So so fertilizing right now can be helpful, especially if you're trying to grow in new grasses, or you're trying to fill in from any areas that were stressed out. I'm not to say that you shouldn't fertilize. It's just one thing that you should definitely be aware of is over fertilizing, and just making sure that you are not fertilizing too much at one time, or you're too excited about trying to encourage the grass to grow. It'll do its thing and it'll do just fine. And some fertilizer in moderation can actually help fill in and provide a better lawn that provides better, arguably better environmental benefits than one that's really thin and, you know, and sparse, for example.
Right, so right.
I could see that argument, but generally we want to encourage people to fertilize in the fall, and that that's when the plants are storing carbohydrates. That's so you are fertilizing the soil. Is what you need to think in terms of. So by fertilizing the soil, you are fertilizing the organisms in the soil, and they are effectively making more nutrients plant available. And so if the plants themselves will start to store a lot of those carbohydrates that organisms are making plant available for them, and they can basically store that either in their storage structures like rhizomes, or in some cases in roots and stems and the crown of the plant. So that's the best time of the year to do it. And it also avoids fertilizing things like crabgrass or other types of weeds. So it, from a strategy standpoint, you can fertilize your lawn without fertilizing the weedy grasses, for example. So there's a lot of different reasons on why to do that in the fall, but it's definitely the preferred time.
And is it only really needed to fertilize once a year?
I think it really depends on, I think it really depends on your soil type. So generally speaking, for every pound, well, maybe that's a little bit too much information for the audience, but I was just going to say that, organic, like soil organic matter levels can have a really significant impact on how much fertilizer would need to be to grow in a lush, dense, thick lawn. And not everybody needs a lush, dense lawn. So I think it's really kind of matching your management style with what you're planning on using the lawn for. Okay. So if you've got like a couple of kids and a golden retriever, for example, or, you know, a bigger dog, that receives more play and activity and traffic and a little bit more stress, maybe that lawn needs to be able to recover from that stress. And so the fertilizer can supplement that. But in the case of, let's say you do have a very light soil, like I think you've mentioned in the past that Sherburne County has, that they're soils with very low organic matter. In those particular cases, fertilizer would be beneficial. It's just whether or not it can be necessary for the lawn, because many lawns don't, you know, necessarily need fertilizer. I'm further south. I live in St. Paul. And so my soil is quite a bit different than yours, but I've only fertilized my lawn one time, and that was because I was really just trying to encourage some fine fescue seedlings to come mm-hmm. in. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily an essential practice that needs to be done, but some fertilizer can certainly help maintain your lawn and help it be resistant to weeds like crabgrass, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Sherburne County, I think the average soil organic matter is maybe 1%. up or down in some areas, depending where you are. So yeah, not a lot of organic matter, very light soil. But I'm glad that you mentioned kind of over-fertilizing, because that's kind of a pretty big concern in areas where we do have really well-drained sandy soils, because excess fertilizer can leach into the groundwater, which we do have some concerns with high nitrates in groundwater in Sherburne County. And a lot of people just assume that it's only coming from agriculture, but it definitely can come from areas where there's just a lot of lawn, because people may not know exactly how much fertilizer they should be putting down. So getting to know your soil type is really essential for something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing to keep in mind there is, you know, because you do have the really sandy soils, they are going to drain much faster. So, mm-hmm. and I think that's part of the thought process behind the nitrate, or it's not the thought process, the fact that the nitrates are getting into the groundwater is because they're actually moving through the soil profile. Mm-hmm. You know, they're leaching. And so if you can, if you are concerned about that and you do still want to be able to fertilize, consider using more organic nitrogen sources, not necessarily certified organic products, but mm-hmm. sources of nitrogen that are not water soluble. So those are sources that will provide a little bit longer feeding process. They're typically lower concentrations of nitrogen, but they are they won't necessarily provide that those nitrates, at least in the short term, for that are more prone to leaching through the ground and into our, you know, our water sources.
Mm-hmm. So can people easily access these more organic sources at like garden centers, or could they make their own, or?
Yes to all of the above. They certainly could make their own, but there's a lot of products out there that are at the retail or, mm-hmm. you know, that are sold commercially to homeowners. So there are plenty available. Many of them are made out of things like a bone feather meal, or they're made out of like turkey or poultry manure, or they might be just made out of regular old cow manure. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, in the case of one or two products, they're made out of human waste from water treatment plants. So there's just a number of different options. And, you know, I think that there's, you know, there's plenty of options available. But again, you know, just be thinking in terms of, you know, how much fertilizer to put down. You know, I think for the most part, for most lawns, you know, we try to base our fertility programs on the pounds of nitrogen applied per 1,000 square feet over the year. And in most lawns, you know, we're recommending, you know, we may recommend 2 to 3 pounds, but that's not necessarily saying that you have to apply 2 to 3 pounds to have a, you know, a healthy looking lawn. And so, but I would think in terms of, or that's where I would start with, is really just trying to understand, okay, how much nitrogen is in this product? Don't just think, oh, just because it's organic, I can apply mm-hmm. as much as I want.
Right.
So really think in terms of how much you're actually putting down. We have tremendous resources on our, I say tremendous, we have pretty good resources on our website for determining how much fertilizer to apply and how to figure out how much nitrogen am I actually applying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So are there like, is there a stage at which the grass might be telling you that it is in need of fertilizer? Like, let's say a landowner may have skipped a year or two. Will there be like yellowing that's really distinct to nutrient deficiencies or wilting? Or what could a homeowner look for when it's time to maybe add a little extra nutrients?
Yeah, the yellowing, or in some cases you'll see stunted growth. So like where you'll see plants there, but they're basically just not growing. And they may have like a more of like yellow or an off green type color. That's to the point where there is actually like a nitrogen deficiency, which could very well happen in really sandy soils that's low in organic matter, like in Sherburne County. That can certainly happen. In many cases, though, I think that certainly can happen. Another thing to do is to consider looking at the indicator weed species around, because what I'm referring to is sometimes when we see a plant in the landscape, that plant is better adapted at certain conditions than others. So Creeping Charlie, for example, one of the most common weeds in Minnesota, loves shade and wet conditions. So we always say, if you have Creeping Charlie, maybe you have really excessive shade and or excessive wet conditions. That's not to say that it has to have those conditions, but that's where you'll find Creeping Charlie first. And so with nitrogen, if you find any of the legume species like the clovers or oxalis, for example, you'll find those species in lower nitrogen situations because they're just a little bit better adapted at those conditions than the grass is. So if you see those species, sometimes that might be an indication that nitrogen would help the lawn itself.
Okay. Very good. So how about we move on to watering? Because we kind of mentioned, you know, leaching of nutrients into the soil. A lot of times that's because there's water moving pretty fast through this the soil profile. I feel like everybody that owns a lawn really needs a lesson on watering. There's a lot of times that, you know, you walk through neighborhoods and there's irrigation systems going on at noon when it's 90 degrees out, half of it's hitting sidewalks. How often do lawns actually need to be watered? Like, do they need twice a day, every single day, or can it be once a week? What is preferred for a good lawn?
Yeah, I hate to say this, but the it depends really could be an answer for every single question. But you know, so I would think in terms of not necessarily what day of the week it is, or what the, you know, the number on my house outside, if it ends in an odd or an even, if we have an irrigation restriction. Don't use anything like that to determine when you should water. Water based on what the, you know, what the lawn actually needs. And we can kind of get into, okay, how to determine how much water the lawn needs. But I would focus on that and use that as a starting point, not necessarily just because, like, let's say, for example, if you have an irrigation system that it needs to run. Realistically, our strategy for grasses, whether they're irrigated or unirrigated, is to promote deep and infrequent irrigation. And the thought process behind that is like, if you just imagine an area that is unirrigated along a roadside, for example, that grass is only getting watered when it rains. And so those plants are going to be continuously trying to grow deeper roots to get more water in this lower in the soil profile, or more moisture from the lower profile. And so so we can train the roots of our lawns by watering less frequently. And but if we do water, we're going to water deeper into the profile, where we're allowing that water to actually get further deeper into the profile. So we're not training the roots to be shallow. And that's one of the challenges. And I think with like irrigation restrictions or watering restrictions, or really just having an irrigation system in general, is that, you know, people think, well, because I have this, I should use it. And my lawn will be green year round. And, you know, and lawns don't have to be green year round for you to have a healthy lawn, to serve its purpose, you know, to use it however you want to use it. I think that's one of the bigger challenges, you know, we have, you know, at the University of Minnesota is trying to educate people that green grass doesn't, you know, a lawn doesn't have to be green to be good. You know, green, a little bit of brown can be a good thing because, you know, if the grass literally never dries out, never, you know, experiences any kind of drought symptoms, there's less incentive for it to grow deeper roots, to become more resilient to drought cycles that are seem to be becoming more commonplace.
Yeah.
And so, so our goal is to try to educate people that many grasses and most of the grasses that we have in our lawns have adaptations in them that they can actually go dormant, or they can avoid some kind of prolonged drought stress. And so allowing the lawn to go a little bit brown or just not be green all the time can actually be better for your lawn in the long run by one, training the roots that, you know, that doesn't have to be shallow, but also you're just actually allowing the plant to go into a natural dormancy that, that they've been adapted for, you know, thousands of years. Right. So, so it's really just trying to kind of get beyond that human aspect of, oh, green is good. And so keeping it green all the time is better for my lawn.
Right.
So the biggest thing to keep in mind, if you are considering letting your lawn try to go dormant, is there's some exceptions there, some things to keep in mind is that, and that's something that we saw in the last 2 years, in 2020, in 2021 and in 2022, where we had severe or exceptional drought. We had cases where lawns did not receive any water for 30 days or more, and any significant amounts of water for 30 days or more. And as a result of that, there was some dieback or death of those areas. And in that case, you know, I think an argument could be made for going out and actually watering to preserve that, to make sure that the plant is actually still alive. And how do you determine that? Well, one, you just basically know that if the lawn itself hasn't received any, you know, if your area hasn't received any rain for that length of time, 30 days or so is about the cutoff for that. Most of the grasses can withstand 45 days without rain or even longer than that. Most of the newer grasses, I should say. But the, you know, the older ones generally are pretty good at out to about 30 days or so. And then at that point, that's when I would consider going out, trying to get some rain, some water into the soil for the plants themselves. And most of the time you can kind of get a feel for that when you're walking on the lawn and it feels literally crunchy.
Right.
Those are the plants actually like breaking, or the soil itself has crusted over and you're, that's what you're feeling, you know, hearing and feeling. So, you know, when it gets to that point, that's when I would start considering it, but pay attention to the weather. You know, maybe there might be some rain coming in the, you know, in the forecast, and you might be able to help it. Or if it does rain a little bit, you know, but only a little bit, maybe you can go out and supply a little bit more just to keep it alive and nurse it along until, you know, until we get into the cooler evening temperatures and some more consistent rainfall events.
Yeah. So, I try to, you know, let landowners know when they call and they're like, my grass is definitely dead, because it's, you know, late July and it's been 90 degrees with no rain, to just be patient. And so you suggest maybe not necessarily watering grasses when they kind of are in their dormant phases until temperatures are a little more suitable for that. Is that kind of how I understood that?
Yeah. You know, if we were to get like a system, like in, let's say middle of July, and we, and, or, you know, like say we don't see any rain for the whole month of July, for example, that's not to say that I would go out and start watering the third or fourth week of July. You know, I'd really just try to keep an eye on the weather and, you know, and if you are going to irrigate, the best time to do that is in the morning, just that way more of the amount of water is actually getting into the soil, and it's less likely to be evaporated off the surface, because, you know, from, you know, the warm sun. So, so think in terms of when to water, but necessarily how frequently. I try to basically, even if my lawn starts to wilt, where it's starting to show early signs or symptoms of drought stress. What that means is that if you're walking on the lawn and you can see your footsteps 10 or 15 minutes after, and you'll see the leaves have started to shrivel up just like any other plant might from drought stress, those are the early signs or symptoms of drought stress. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's just kind of a sign to say, hey, I should probably change how I'm using my lawn, because I don't want to stress it out further going into a stressful time period. So that's just the plant trying to conserve as much water as possible. So maybe, you know, definitely don't mow when it's
drought. I was going to ask that. Yeah. Yeah. So you definitely, not mowing while the plant is starting to turn and going dormant. That's a good to note, because I definitely see people mowing brown grass and having just dust spread everywhere.
Yeah, that's one of the worst things to do. I mean, mowing is already a natural stress on the plants. So, mowing when the plant is already stressed is really one of the best ways of killing your lawn. So, so definitely don't do that. Kind of the beauty of silver lining of there being some kind of drought is the fact that the plants themselves are just not growing very much. They don't, because there's not enough water for them to grow, they really don't need to be mowed. So just staying off them, from a mower perspective, but maybe even consider changing how you yourself or your pets use your lawn. Mm-hmm. So, everybody, most people, have a lawn because they enjoy using it. And so, I think there is a temptation there to be like, well, the summertime is when I want to use my lawn the most. But, it's really just, it could mean just staying off of it when it's above 90 degrees, for example. Mm-hmm. If that were the case, that would go a really long way for having a great lawn the rest of the year, other than just that 1 or 2 weeks of stress, for example.
Yeah. And kind of building on mowing, everybody seems to mow, they have their Saturday, Sunday, they mow every week. Is that what people should be doing, or kind of following watering? You don't necessarily want to actually have a set routine, but kind of, is it get better to just mow when it seems like it's the right time?
Absolutely. So I think, I think that can go, one of the biggest impacts that people can make on their lawn is simply just raising the mowing height, half an inch or an inch.
Yeah.
The consensus with research, with what we know about turf is that we don't want to remove any more than 1/3 of the total above ground plant parts and on any given mowing. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you mow your lawn at 4 inches, you wouldn't want to mow it until it gets to about 6 inches tall. Which most people are, definitely do not have a 6-inch tall lawn, but by mowing it at a higher height, you have a lawn that you're having to mow it less frequently, because if you're mowing 1/3 at a time, or no more than 1/3, if you're mowing your lawn at 3 inches, you would effectively need to mow it when it gets up to 4 inches. So in that 3 inches to 4 inches, that's a much shorter time period than if you're mowing from 4 and allowing it to grow up to 6 inches. Mm-hmm. And we've seen some research in the lawns and the grasses that grow in Minnesota, where that could be 7 fewer mowing events throughout the year. Wow. So is by just simply mowing it as it's needed, and not even just changing the mowing height, but just mowing it as it's needed, as opposed to just mowing every Sunday.
Right.
So there's a substantial cost savings. There's fewer greenhouse gas emissions, and it's less stress on your lawn itself, by doing that.
And less time spending in your yard and more time enjoying it.
Yeah, I think so. Even though, I know that there's a lot of people who think mowing is very therapeutic, but if you are not having, Sunday afternoon or something like that, where your lawn is looking a little bit longer, if you were just to follow the 1/3 rule, maybe you don't need to mow until Tuesday or Wednesday, for example. Mm-hmm. So, those couple extra days added up over the year could be pretty substantial for the amount that many fewer times you would need to mow.
Absolutely. And, you mentioned, a reduction of greenhouse gases, but also a reduction of noise pollution, because man, it's not pleasant to have to listen to a bunch of lawnmowers going off all weekend long.
Yeah. And I think the best thing about raising your mowing height is, I saved the best for last here, or if it is the last, but the best thing about raising your mowing height is that it means that you're you're effectively training your roots to grow a little bit deeper. So a lot of people are familiar with like a tree. So if you look at a tree, you can imagine that same amount of root, you know, the above ground, that same amount of root growth is present below ground. Well, the same thing is true for your lawn and for your grasses, or really any plant, is that the plant kind of mirrors its above ground growth with its below ground. And so if you raise the mowing height, you actually get more and deeper roots. And so that makes your lawn more drought resilient and drought tolerant. So the other added benefit is that your lawn becomes more restrictive, or it reduces the amount of pressure from things like crabgrass. So crabgrass prefers lower mowing heights. So just raising your lawn height means you mow less, it's water resilient, and it's resistant to things like crabgrass. And, you know, more recently, there's some research to show that maybe there might be some benefit behind mowing a little bit taller for pollinators, but I think the jury is still out on that. But there is some data to suggest that that is the case. So if you are concerned about promoting pollinators, you know, having a little bit higher mowing height can, in theory, have more flowers for those pollinators and some benefit to them.
That's an excellent segue into lawn alternatives. That's kind of the last thing I wanted to talk about, was to get your opinion or, you know, professional expertise on the different lawn alternatives that are out there for folks that maybe do want to add some pollinator habitat into their lawn. Whether there's bee lawn mixes, I know the U of M has created one, but there's also, you know, some people are trying like clover only lawns, or, you know, the no mow or low mow mixes. What's your opinion on those?
I think where people should, I think many of those are great, because we're getting better at matching the type of lawn habitat that someone wants to have with what they're trying to get out of it. So if your priority is to have a lawn where your kids can have a safe pit for you, your pets, or your kids, safe place for them to play, the traditional American lawn can work great for you. If you're somebody who's looking for, you know, doesn't really care about any of those things, but is just like, well, I've got this space and I've got a lot of sun, I could grow some plants that would be beneficial to pollinators, we've got something for you there too. And then we also have hybrids that can work well, you know, kind of a hybrid system that could meet both of those needs. So where we're at right now, we're getting much better at basically understanding how to plant plants in this landscape that can tolerate multiple uses. And so, in the case of things like the bee lawn mixtures, you know, we've been doing research for almost 10 years for identifying perennial plants that can tolerate regular mowing that still provide good forage or food for pollinators. So there's several different bee lawn mixtures out there that can work great. But there's also, you know, if you're looking for the traditional American lawn, but you know, mow it less, there's also things like low mow or no mow fine fescues. Those will grow a little bit taller. They're not necessarily going to include pollinators, but they can. Those are a great alternative for somebody if they like the aesthetics of a traditional American lawn, but don't necessarily want to mow it quite as often. I think that's a great suggestion. And you know, to your question about the clover lawns and things like that, I think clovers, or incorporating clovers, which by the way happen to be part of the bee lawn mixtures, at least one of the clover species does. The clover lawns are kind of a mixed bag, because I think that they are great because they provide pollinators, suitable pollinator habitat. In theory, they provide some nitrogen for the lawn. So I understand why they would be appealing. They're cheap seed, and they're very easy to establish. The catching point on the clovers is that even the perennial types have kind of a short lifespan. And unless they're reseeding themselves, a lot of times we'll just get outcompeted by other plants that become less beneficial or less desirable. So So they would require some future seedings. They're not necessarily, even if they're a true perennial, which by the way, you know, they can be, and there's multiple, there's annual and perennial types. The white clover is the most commonly used mm-hmm. perennial type that, that mm-hmm. does spread and fill in some voids. One of the disadvantages of the clover is that it's fairly poor traffic tolerant. Right. So, you know, so if you have, you know, kids, pets, yourself, you know, it, depending on how you use your lawn, clover, you know, you can establish it, but it may not necessarily persist very long, depending on how it's used. But with all of that said, I still think that they're a great alternative. And I think people can should consider incorporating them in, mm-hmm. especially if they're not receiving a whole lot of traffic.
Right. Yeah. So maybe spots like, would they do well under trees? Because I know a lot of our traditional grass mixes, I know not much goes well under certain trees, but maybe dappled shade, can they handle something like that? Or they really need more sun?
That's another one of the disadvantages of the clovers that I'm glad you kind of brought up, is that they are a little bit less a little bit less shade tolerant even than some of our turf grasses. So you can try them in kind of like a, you know, like let's say a somewhat shaded area, and I think that they would probably do pretty well. But you know, many of our lawn grasses, as they are, they can persist much better in the shade than the clover can, and mm-hmm. our grasses are, you know, adapted for, you know, open sun conditions. So, you know, the clovers, it's a little bit of a disadvantage, but I still think, you know, I think they're worth trying, especially if you're interested in all of those benefits I mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, bee lawn mix is great for kind of lower use areas or, you know, parts of your lawn that it's, you're not going to be hanging out anyway. Provide great habitat for those pollinators that need some resource, especially in developed areas where there's just not a ton of natural spaces. Might as well get it in the lawn.
Exactly.
So I think that's kind of the bulk of what I wanted to talk about today. Do you have any like last minute take home messages or resources you want to send people where they can find all of this great information that we talked about today?
Absolutely. So, well, first I would just say, you know, like if you are really interested in promoting pollinators and you're considering taking part in something like No-Mow May, which is the premise of not mowing for the whole month of May in order to promote pollinators within your lawn, you know, we definitely know that there are better ways of promoting pollinators than just not mowing, and not mowing for the entire month of May and then you know, mowing the first week of June, for example, could end up having really negative impacts on your lawn. And so it's really, you know, if you're really concerned about pollinators, you know, consider a bee lawn mixture. You know, I think something like that is a great alternative. And I think it's a great outlet for people. And I think it's, No-Mow May, I think, is if that's what's getting you interested, sure, feel free to take part in it, but consider minimal mowing May, for example, you know, and just mowing maybe just once or twice, you know, instead of, you know, waiting until it gets a foot and a half tall, for example, or a foot tall, and then mowing the first week of June. So that's a, you know, that's something that I think is fairly timely, and it's very popular right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're trying to spread the good word, even myself, the University of Minnesota Bee Lab. You know, we're basically all on the same page for trying to promote pollinators as much as possible. No-Mow may not be the best option for that.
Yeah, what's the new tagline? Is slow-mo summer, right?
Yeah, that's what we're rolling with right now. But I think you know, I think it basically is, it, you know, regardless, I think it's the premise is just raise the mowing height, and you get to check a lot of different boxes by doing just that one simple practice. As far as the resources are concerned, we do have quite a bit of resources available on the internet, on our web pages. The University of Minnesota extension.umn.edu is a great resource for finding extension materials for pretty much all things, you know, in the green space related. But, you know, we also have a webpage for specific to turf things. It's a little bit more research and professional oriented, but turf.umn.edu. Everything is free online from the University of Minnesota. So, you know, for where we're trying to really just provide support and tools for people to be able to, manage their lawn a little bit more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can include some of those links wherever we post the podcast so people can have easy access to all of that excellent information. But so that basically wraps up the first episode in our podcast series. John, thank you so much for joining me today. It was really great to have you provide all of that really great information. And I know homeowners will definitely be using that to help improve their lawns and maybe reduce some of their environmental impacts. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Franny. And if you do have any questions, my contact information can be found on the internet, on the extension web pages, or you can, if you do need some other extension support, you can go to ask extension and get to us that way.
Excellent.
But thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for more episodes in our conservation podcast series.